But first, Barbara Ehrenreich is known as a deep thinker, a social activist, and the author of the influential book Nickel and Dimed. But now Ehrenreich is grappling with something more personal and harder to put into words.
Ehrenreich's new memoir centers on her teenage quest for truth and the experiences that came along with it when she was still a teenager.
The daughter of avowed atheists, she waited until now to try to make sense of what it meant and how what happened to her affected the way she sees her life in the universe. Barbara, it's a pleasure to have you with us.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
Well, when did you realize that you needed something inside you, needed to go back and make sense of the experiences that you had when you were a teenager, when you were on this kind of quest to find truth?
Well, I can't say there was an exact point when I decided to turn my part of my attention toward this. But it certainly helped that in 2001, I came across the journal I had kept as a teenager. And I knew it was there, I guess, but I had never looked at it. All these decades had gone by, and it had somehow managed to come with me everywhere I moved. I saw it, and I thought, okay, someday, very soon, I have to go back to this and read it and transcribe it.
And what the journals are a record of several years when you were starting with, I think, when you were 14, and you were on this mission to kind of figure out what life was about. That's kind of a bold mission for a 14-year-old. What made you think you had
to
do that?
Well, I actually started on this mission when I was 12.
So
I didn't start the journal recording my progress or lack thereof until I was 14. But, you know, I think a lot of people have a point, often in childhood or adolescence, where they say, hey, wait a minute, what is this all about? We're born, we live, we die. What does it add up to? You know, I think that's pretty common, right?
And you called it the situation.
Yeah, I began to see it as a distinct situation that human beings were in, and without anybody much talking about it. You know, perhaps religious people talked about it more, but always, you know, by eliminating the death part, by saying, you know, this is all, we're just fulfilling some plan of a divine being. Now, my parents were atheists. Religion was not a factor in how we saw the world, except insofar as we were occasionally harassed for being atheists. But other than that, it was not something I would turn to.
So here you are, you're 12 when you start this quest for truth, and you're living in this family of atheists, and it's a rough upbringing. It's not like you could just go to your mom and your dad and say, help me figure this thing out. Where did you turn?
No, it was It was a difficult family. My parents got married too young. My father was originally a copper miner in Butte, Montana. They were, you know, from blue-collar families, and experienced a rather rapid, looking back on it, upward mobility, so that by the time I was 10 or 12, we were beginning to be really middle class. And I think that was all very disorienting, plus a lot of geographical moves. And it certainly didn't help that both parents were alcoholics.
And so where did you go when you started this quest? How did you begin your search?
I didn't know how to do it. I thought, well, where do I look? In the library. Okay, look in library books, first thought. Or maybe it's in another form. Maybe some, you know, piece of music. Maybe some pattern is going to emerge just out of things around me that will reveal what I'm looking for. So mostly I read and read and read.
Right, and you counted things like the number of birds flying by, looking for numerical patterns. And at one point you read the Upanishads and decided you were a Hindu.
I decided I was a Hindu. On the basis of nothing but reading the Upanishads, I didn't know anything about actual Hindu practice or, the pantheon of deities. I knew almost nothing about that. But I was intrigued because it seemed that here were people asking or looking at similar giant issues.
Well, so in one day, you were on one of these forced family excursions going to a horse show, and you had something happen to you that you had never had before, this feeling that you describe of everything being stripped away, everything that had to do with language and meaning, and it was interesting to you to see what was left. Can you describe what happened?
I have since learned that there is a psychiatric term for that. That's called dissociation. And it's usually viewed as a disorder, something wrong. If you suddenly see the world as if this layer of human meanings and words had been stripped away from it. I didn't find it scary. I found it intriguing. I thought, well, maybe this is the real world here that I'm seeing now. But, of course, I didn't talk to anybody about these little episodes. I had the good sense to know that would not be probably well received.
Especially when you were growing up. Yeah, so how often did you have those feelings of dissociation?
I don't have any way of answering that numerically. And the references, even in my journal, are at first very guarded, as if I understood that was something kind of off limits. Not that I expected anybody else to ever read my journal. I suppose I don't know. So I would say they were. This is an odd thing. Much more frequent in sunlight. So the winter was kind of safer territory. In terms of avoiding these dissociative episodes.
Well, what did you make about that? So you've got these data points now of these altered experiences with what we know as reality, and you're searching for truth. So how did you file away those experiences?
No, I didn't know how to put it together. I guess I opened up to the possibility that what we all call reality as humans, and we agree is our shared reality, is maybe not all that there is.
And what about looking back at them now? You had another experience that I want to get to, but all of this you're sort of sifting through the eyes of adulthood and the experience behind you, but looking back now at those experiences of dissociation, what do you think of?
It makes sense to me, psychologically, even physiologically, you might say. It takes a lot of work on our part to perceive the world. You don't just see a desk. You see, certain photons enter your retina, but there's a long process by which the brain puts together the idea of desk. Now, if you short-circuit that process because you're tired, or as I probably was when it first happened, then it's you see something very different. And I think this is not an uncommon experience either. But again, where are the numbers?
And you had another experience later on. This was sort of the one that blew the lid off everything you were thinking about and all the experiences you'd had. You were on a road trip with your brother and a guy named Dick who was driving the car. Tell us what happened, would you?
Well, we ended up staying overnight in the car, sleeping in the car, somewhere in the Sierra Nevadas, Lone Pine, California. And when I woke up, and it was still pre-dawn, I got out of the car very quietly, left the other two sleeping, and started walking around these strange streets, probably mainly looking for a restroom. And suddenly, this kind of, I don't know what the word would be, epiphany, revelation, took place. And I want to say right away, this has nothing to do with hallucinations, nothing to do with any drugs, there were no visions. I saw no faces, heard no voices. But the world seemed to come to life. It seemed to, like, flame into life. And the feelings that went with this were very powerful. You could say ecstasy, but you have to also add an element of almost terror at the magnitude of what was going on. So this is the kind of thing I later realized that other people, if it happened to many people, they would say that was God.
And what did you say?
That didn't occur to me.
What did you say to yourself after this thing, this time when everything flamed to life and you talk about standing in storefronts and watching teacups that are sort of on fire? How did you process that without God?
Imagine a universe without God, for a start. I mean, where does this idea come from, that there would be this, you know, giant, a supernatural being? That was not in my mental lexicon. I thought there were two possibilities, and it took me a while to think clearly enough. I mean, it took me really several months before I could think clearly enough to even distinguish the possibilities. One, which would be the, quote, realistic way of seeing it, was that there was some kind of mental breakdown. Temporary mental breakdown. It had to do with being overtired and probably a little hypoglycemic, who knows. And that, you know, it had no other significance at all. But the second possibility, the strange one, which I guess intersects with your question about God, is that it had been an encounter with something, some being, some other mind, utterly strange to me, or probably to unrelated to anything human.
Well, we'll talk more about that and find out how you've dealt with that and what you've thought in the years after as we talk with Barbara Ehrenreich, the best-selling author of Nickel and Dimed. She has a new memoir out. It's called Living with a Wild God, a Nonbeliever's Search for the Truth About Everything.
And we welcome your calls now. If you have a question for Barbara Ehrenreich about her experience or if you've had a similar moment, this epiphany, if you'd like to call it that, and you see it as part of our homework here on Earth to figure out why we're here. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with Barbara Ehrenreich now, the best-selling author of Nickel and Dimed. Now Barbara has a new memoir out. It's called Living with a Wild God, a Nonbeliever's Search for the Truth About Everything.
She tells her story about her search for truth starting around age 12, epiphanies she encountered along the way. And we want to hear from you. Is it our job to ask these questions, to seek out why we're here, what we're meant to be doing? And have you had a moment, a transformative moment that changed the way you look at the universe you live in? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
Barbara, we were just talking about this experience you had. If you liked the term, I would call it a mystical experience, but you were reluctant to call it that, where the world sort of flamed to life and you felt a kind of ecstasy mixed with terror. And you write that you should have died then, that moment was kind of the ultimate experience of reality. How did it shape your life?
It's hard to say. The reason I felt I should have died was I felt I knew what I had been looking for. I now had a glimpse of it. But I couldn't put it into words. And so what did I really know? So I was stuck. I didn't quite know why I was alive anymore, or, you know, I know it's no longer clear about my mission. I did go on to college, which was sort of life-saving. Very life-saving, in that I threw my intellect into science. I said, well, this is what I'm going to do now. I'm going to try to reconstruct the world, the truth about everything, you know, starting with the subatomic particles or, you know, and building on from there.
I want to go to our callers now. We've got some folks waiting to talk with you. And let's go to Don joining us first in Norwalk. Hi, Don.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. This is an enjoyable conversation. I just I'm reminded on several points from, you know, the things Barbara's saying there. And one of them is that this dissociated part is similar in some ways, although maybe more positive, to Sartre's Nausea, the book Nausea.
Oh, yes.
But yes. I had to say, you know, I've, you know, gone through some stuff like this, too. I mean, I'm 65 years old and was considered myself a hippie back in the 60s and all this stuff. And, again, non-drug. I mean, you just think about this stuff hard enough, long enough, and I think these things happen to you.
Uh-huh.
But what happened to me was sort of like G.K. Chesterton talks about a guy that leaves from England sailing to find undiscovered lands and by mistake ends up back in England and thinks it's some different place. And what I'm getting at is I ended up back in Catholicism because if you go long enough through a whole variety of perspectives, you sort of rediscover things. And the image that comes to me sometimes is we all are trying to figure this stuff out. It's like we're all pressed up against this great wall that we're, like, feeling our hands along, trying to find the entrance to the other side. And right next to us, there's this huge door with neon signs flashing on and off that say entrance. And to me, that's kind of what Catholicism is. And not discounting any of the mystical and ecstatic states that Barbara talks about. I mean, it's all included. So anyway, I guess there's a lot of routes in there, but that's what happened to me anyway.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for that call, Don.
That's interesting. You know, one sort of, I did research. This is it's a memoir. That's the action and the narrative comes from my life. But I did research, too. And one of the things I did, which was a very strange thing for an atheist to do, was read some of the Christian mystics. These are all Catholics in the cases I read. Very devout people. But I could find similarities in what they described as their mystic experiences. If I took out the word God, if I took out the idea that there was a benign person-like being somewhere, then I felt a real connection.
All right. Well, thank you for that call. And I want to ask you a little about where you are now. The book of the title of your book is called, the subtitle, you know, Living with a Wild God, a Nonbeliever's Search for the Truth About Everything. Do you still consider yourself an atheist, having gone through this experience, having read the mystics and maybe seen similarities
in
experience?
Oh, yes. I think, actually, the test of anybody, whether somebody is a true atheist, is that they should go through an experience like this and see if they come out as an atheist. You know, if you're tempted to say, oh, that must be God, trying to contact me or something, then all right, that's over. But I have no sign in that direction. There was no face to this. There was no nothing familiar in a human way.
So what is the force in the universe, then, that you write about that might, you think, be coming for us?
Well, what I end up speculating about in the book is the possibility that there are other conscious beings in the universe that are at this point not easily detectable to us, but that we can, you know, that we may sometimes be in contact with. Now, I have to immediately say I am not talking about some particular type of spirits, but just, you know, there are things that science has ignored because it is so hard, has been so hard for science to acknowledge the existence of non-human consciousness, of even, you know, the beings around us. Science more or less absolutely maintained until a couple of decades ago that non-human animals, for example, have no consciousness, awareness, feelings, etc. Well, we're learning a lot more about that. In fact, weirdly enough, the discussion has moved on to plants. But the tendency of science built in to some of the, you know, notion, Descartes, Cartesian notions of science, is that everything in the world is dead. And it's very shocking to find that there may be other beings.
Well, Barbara, it's a fascinating journey. Thank you for sharing it with us and for talking today.
Oh, you're welcome.
We've been talking to Barbara Ehrenreich, the best-selling author of Nickel and Dime, talking about her new memoir called Living with a Wild God, a non-believer's search for the truth about everything. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we'll go time-traveling through our state's history with some help from Old World Wisconsin.
First, the Ukrainian government says it's cleared roadblocks in eastern Ukraine that had been claimed by Russian separatists after a military operation that killed militants, while Russian troops have started new military exercises on the border and Russian leaders have voiced criticism of Ukrainian action.
Meanwhile, the United States deployed a small number of troops to Poland, with more to come in the Baltic states to help reassure NATO allies in eastern Europe. Joining us to break down what's going on is William Pomeranz. He's deputy director of the Kennan Institute for Advanced Russian Studies of the Woodrow Wilson Center and adjunct professor at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University. Will, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be back.
Well, all this is going on after this Geneva deal that was reached last week. What was that supposed to accomplish?
Well, the Geneva deal was supposed to require that the militants or separatists, or however you describe them, in the eastern part of Ukraine disarm and abandon the government buildings that they had taken over. It allowed for observers to come from the OSCE, and it was supposed to begin the process of drafting a new Ukrainian constitution. I think events have raced ahead yet again, and that I think that enforcement or implementation of that Geneva agreement now is very much in doubt, as both sides are behaving much more aggressively.
So the concept of that, even as being a framework for future diplomacy, is pretty much gone?
Well, it depends on somehow getting together and beginning to draft a Ukrainian constitution. And that doesn't seem to be in the cards right now, although there has been some talk about that. But even more importantly, clearly no one has disarmed. And the level in violence has steadily grown in eastern Ukraine. And we now have the Russians engaged in extensive military drills exactly on the border.
So the question, as it was with Crimea, which we talked about last time you were on, is what does Russia want? I've heard some leading Russian officials say, we don't want to end up owning eastern Ukraine, in part because it would be really expensive for us. Is eastern Ukraine different from Crimea in Russian eyes, do you think?
Well, it is. I think it's a much more extensive military operation. They have the added problem that whereas the majority of the population on Crimea were ethnic Russians, that is not the case in eastern Ukraine. So they would have to occupy major cities. They would have to deal with domestic discontent and most likely opposition to any sort of occupation. And finally, the Russians are right. It would be very expensive, not only in terms of what they have to pay to occupy these regions, but also for the sanctions that would inevitably come if indeed Russia were to move into eastern Ukraine.
You mentioned Ukrainian constitution. I've seen some indications that Russia is hoping for kind of more devolved power, a federal system that might give more autonomy to areas with a larger Russian population. Is that on the table as a Russian bargaining point?
Well, it's on the table, and I think even Kiev and Ukrainians are willing to discuss some devolution of power to the regions. Ukraine is governed as a unitary state with really highly centralized powers in Kiev, and I think there's some agreement that certain powers should be transferred to the regions. There's discussion to have elections of governors in Ukraine and to designate certain financial resources that would flow to the regions. So I think there is clear agreement that some sort of federal solution is warranted in Ukraine. The problem with what the Russians are advocating is not really a federal solution, but a confederation solution, where Ukraine really ceases to function as a unified state because of the significant amount of powers that would be transferred to the regions. So I think they're using the same word, but there's clearly different understandings of what a federal Ukraine would look like.
Under that system, maybe those eastern Ukrainian portions would have their own foreign policy and trade policy, presumably more friendly to Russia.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, how much sovereignty would be transferred to the regions? Would they indeed be able to conduct their own foreign policy? Would they be able to declare their kind of independence, as occurred in Russia during the 1990s, when Russia itself was a much weaker federal state? So there is a real question as to how much autonomy would be granted these regions. I think the one thing that also has to be emphasized is that economically, these regions are oriented towards Russia. So obviously, going forward, if you give them greater autonomy, you're most likely to trade with your neighbors, and obviously the most important neighbor here is Russia. So one would imagine, even as Ukraine wanted to move to greater kind of economic integration with the EU, there would still be significant pressure to continue old trade relations with Russia in eastern Ukraine.
We've seen this military action in Ukraine against what they're calling militants, pro-Russian militants, and you mentioned the Russian military exercises by the border. Seems right now and in recent weeks, the main battle has been on the information grounds, an information war. Ukraine saying Russians are directly supporting these militants, in fact, trying to make the case that some of the militants are actually Russian agents. They were circulating pictures to journalists and diplomats. Meanwhile, Russians are saying the U.S. is coordinating the Ukrainian response here. How much of the facts on the ground can we actually all agree on all sides here?
Well, I think we could agree that there are clearly people coming in from Russia into these eastern Ukrainian cities who are engaged in various sorts of activities. One assumes that they are under some sort of general coordination from Russia. That would explain the coordinated attacks that occurred a few weeks ago in several of these eastern Ukrainian cities at the same time. But
Will, are you still there?
Yes, I'm still here.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. We thought we lost you for a sec.
Oh, no. The number of separatists have not been clarified. Are there hundreds? Are there thousands? It's not clear. And what is also interesting is the information war for the Russians really is in many ways for their domestic population and for those eastern Russian-speaking Ukrainians to kind of stir up trouble in that part of the region.
Meanwhile, the U.S. response is developing. We now have, I think it was 150 paratroopers in Poland, more to come in the Baltic states. It's not a large force. What does it mean?
Well, I think it essentially means that the U.S. is going to stand by its defensive commitments to its NATO allies. And since the collapse of the Soviet Union, those allies include the three Baltic states, Poland, and several other European countries. And I think these actions are being done to demonstrate that support. And it's important because there's still ethnic Russian speakers in many of the Baltic states. And theoretically, Putin could use the same arguments in the Baltic states as he's using in Ukraine, with the significant difference that the Baltic states are a part of NATO.
That reminds me of one bigger picture question I wanted to ask. There have been accusations, especially from Putin and Russia, that NATO was too aggressive in eastward expansion, adding allies like Poland, as you mentioned. Putin saying, hey, there's no Warsaw Pact, there's no Soviet Union. Who is this directed against? Is this containment against modern-day Russia? Was NATO too aggressive?
Well, that's a very interesting question, and it goes back to the reasons why NATO expanded during the 1990s and early 2000s. There is a great debate as to whether President Bush and President Gorbachev at that time agreed that there would be no NATO expansion. And Putin also often cites Gorbachev as saying that the U.S. had agreed that there would not be that expansion of NATO. But I think the mission of NATO has evolved since the collapse of the Soviet Union. This issue really wasn't discussed in depth at the time of the collapse, of the unification of Germany. And finally, there was no really written documentation saying that there could be no expansion of NATO. I think there was a real objection in the 1990s, I should say, because, as you implied, the Warsaw Pact had collapsed and there was no apparent mission for NATO in its previous form. But NATO has evolved. There have been plenty of meetings between Russians and NATO over the past decade, and NATO remains a defensive alliance. So all in all, I don't think necessarily NATO expanded too fast, And unfortunately, I think events are confirming what people had thought back in the 1990s, that if Russia became stronger, it could indeed begin to threaten its former Warsaw allies.
Well, and here we are. What do you see as priorities for diplomats trying to resolve this peacefully?
Well, we're kind of have to go back to the diplomatic table, aren't we? We were there just last week in Geneva, and what we came up with was something that clearly could not hold. So either we go back to the diplomatic table and try to come up with a more concrete agreement, or events will continue to race ahead. I'm not quite sure where diplomacy intervenes at this point in light of the heated rhetoric of the last 24 hours. Clearly, Ukraine has decided that it wants to maintain the territorial integrity of the rest of the country, and Russia, by conducting these military drills, is objecting in a very loud manner. So diplomacy is becoming, I think, more difficult to pursue as each side pursues what it perceives as its mission.
Will, thanks a lot for joining us again.
My pleasure.
That was William Pomeranz with the Woodrow Wilson Center.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Every summer, Old World Wisconsin offers what they call Time Travelers Adventure Camps. It gives kids from preschool to high school a chance to experience life in the late 18th and early 19th centuries firsthand.
Ann Selke is with us to talk about the Time Travelers Adventure Camps. She's the day camp coordinator for Old World Wisconsin. Ann, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thanks for giving me a chance to talk about our great Time Traveler Adventure Camps today.
Right. Well, give us the scoop. What are these Time Travelers Adventure Camps?
Well, they're a great, rare opportunity for kids to experience life in the time period from the late 1800s to the early 1900s. It's sort of like an immersion where they get a chance to come to our wonderful 560-plus acres, and we're out in the woods, and we're living life just like they did in those days. We have a wide variety, as you mentioned. We can go anywhere from the Mubah camp with parent and child all the way through my teenagers who go all the way through seniors in high school.
And what do kids get out of these time travel experiences?
Well, first of all, they get a chance to do some things that are becoming rarer and rarer among our modern children. They get to spend time outdoors, exploring the outdoors in our natural settings with the woods and our animals are animals that they might not see. They learn about the heritage of animals and how the farmers used animals in that time period, what it was like to depend on these animals for your living and for your life to keep you going. They also learn a lot about our various gardening and farming, what it was like to have a farm that was a sustenance farm. They get to do lots of activities, too. We have lots of hands-on activities. They may be sewing. They may be baking. They may be making a craft. They may be playing a game that came from that time period.
So what does Old World Wisconsin kind of do to recreate these periods and times? How deep does it go? Are there costumes or historically accurate, you know, clothes that people are wearing and music? How deep does the experience actually take us?
Well, all of our camps have some aspect of the kids being able to take themselves back into that time period and dress appropriately. It starts with the little kids, the real tiny kids. We don't really dress them up too much because they're young enough that that throws them off a little bit, and we don't want them to be anxious when they're out here. But after that, we have our one-room schoolhouse. Everyone has some kind of apparel that takes them back in time. That particular day camp is very immersive. We do everything just like they did back in 1906 in the Raspberry Schoolhouse in Raspberry Bay up near Bayside. Then we go through other camps. I supply the outfits. A lot of the camps, like Living Like Laura, our Laura camp, they come dressed because they love to have their full costume on. And then when we get to our teenagers, they have complete costumes just like our interpretive staff. We supply all of it.
And no cell phones allowed, I bet?
That's right, no cell phones. They're allowed to bring them, but after that, they're silenced. We don't have any kind of technology yet. I've toyed with the idea, but half the fun is like in our schoolhouse using a slate. It's fascinating to kids to write on a piece of slate with a slate pencil, and you erase it with, you know, your hand or your arm, and it just seems to really fascinate them that this ever existed.
The original tablet.
That's right.
Well, I'm curious about the Little House Adventures Camp. I'm taking this, you're pulling from the life of Laura Ingalls Wilder, who spent some time here in Wisconsin. What is that camp like? What do campers get to do?
Well, we try to draw off of the book Little House in the Big Woods because we have one of our buildings out here, Fossebrecher, is quite similar to the small cabin that Laura and Pa and Ma started out in. It's even maybe a little smaller than theirs. But it has some of the activities like I could quiz you and ask you, do you know what chinking is? Which is chinking. Actually taking mud and straw and filling in the spaces in between the logs. Oh. It's something that, you know, we don't think about, right?
No, not really.
And they make cornbread like Laura would have. We try to do whatever Laura would have done. We make sometimes we make button bracelets. We make cloves with clove apples, which are for Christmas presents. We play some of the games that they played. So it's a short camp. We like to do our hiking. We go to the store, just like Laura would have done.
And you get to fight with Nellie Olson?
Well, we try to avoid conflict in our camps.
Well, that said, here's a related one. You've got one called Survivor Pioneer Wisconsin. That sounds pretty intense. What goes on there?
Well, that one's one of our newer camps, and we're taking a modern theme like Survivor, or our other new one is Amazing Race, and taking some of the aspects of those shows that kids are familiar with and using our area to kind of make them think, what would it be like? I think our Survivor is not quite as hard as a Survivor on TV, but we are going to be intense in that they're not going to be able to do anything modern. We're going to have them start their own fire. They have to find the wood. They have to use a flint and steel. They have to find some kind of food while they're out here. And not necessarily everything can come from our gardens. We're going to work on that. And we're also going to have to find some wood to build some kind of a shelter. So that will be a little bit of a challenge. Amazing Race is going to be really fun because we're going to have a lot of little challenges. And it's mostly just to see if you can complete the entire race. I'm not going to be emphasizing the timing as much like they do on the show, but just can you complete all the challenges?
I'm curious, did you get the idea for these from some of the reality TV shows that have been out there, like Frontier House on PBS?
Actually, not really, no. You know, I think that originally our day camps were a vision of one of the members of the Old World Foundation, and she really wanted to see kids have a chance to experience with a lot of hands-on activities, and we've been around for 11 years, and we had a director who just really wanted kids to learn from this experience. So I don't think it's really a TV thing. Maybe Amazing Race and Survivor, we kind of took their themes. But no, I don't think we ever really looked at Frontier House, although I have watched it.
It's a good show.
And our producer, Amanda, just sent a note, says, I want to do these camps. Is there a way for grown-ups to play?
Well, actually, we do have some workshops. They're not quite, I think they're not quite as much fun as my day camps, though. They're more grown up. Sometimes the parents are like, oh, we want to do that mud and straw chinking thing.
Who wouldn't?
So people have to really immerse themselves in this pace of life, which is, I'm guessing, a lot slower. And there might be more hard work than kids are used to when they're, you know, their average camp, which is aimed at just entertaining the child and enriching them too. But I'm wondering if participants come away changed when they leave these camps.
Well, you know, it is interesting. The younger kids, a lot of times, I've had parents say to me, maybe a year or two later, they'll come up with something like, "Do you remember how to make butter? I know how to make butter. I learned it at Old World." Or, "Do you know what rev work is?" And they all of a sudden want to do it. Now, my apprentices, it is a very much a life-changing thing for them. They're teenagers, and I have had apprentices that have changed from, you know, kind of awkward teenagers into very poised, able to deal with the public, grown-up people. So they come away with a lot of people skills. They learn a little bit about endurance because we don't have air conditioning out here.
Mm.
And they learn to pace themselves. So I think they come away with a little more appreciation for how hard it was to live.
And is there any kind of financial aid available for these camps?
Well, we do have one particular camp that there is financial aid for, and that is the Apprentice Camp. That camp is 4 days long, so it's $160 for the camp. And one of our donors is someone who has a barn here on our property, and the Loomer family has offered to help subsidize that because they felt that their teenager got so much from the camp that they are willing to fund other teenagers to come here. It's $100. There's no financial need involved. It's just a matter of contacting me and asking for it.
So, Anne, I want to ask you our last question here in our last 30 seconds. If you had to live in one of these camps every day, like in Groundhog Day, where every day you get up and you're in that camp, which one would you choose?
Well, it's a tie because I'm a school teacher in the afternoon, so I'd want to be in that Raspberry Schoolhouse all the time, but I'd also like to be Laura. I love the cooking. I love the chinking and dealing with the log cabin and the animals.
Ah, that sounds like fun.
Anne, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. I hope to see a lot of people coming out for our adventures and have a fun time traveling with us.
That was Anne Selke, day camp coordinator for Old World Wisconsin, with us to talk about the time traveler adventure camps. And I've learned a new word. I don't know if I'll get to use it. Chinking.
Put it into practice. Hopefully not in your own house.
Yeah.
But maybe some other setting.
Extra insulation.